So, this is an interview with Brian and Paul Emery, brothers, and their cousin Margaret Emery, by Katrina Spencer on the 10th of January 2018. And it is part of the Campbelltown City Council Oral History Project, Our Fruitful Record, A History of Market Gardens in Campbelltown. So thank you for being part of this. Margaret, what's your full name?
My name's Margaret Jane Emery.
And your date of birth?
The 27th of July 1949.
And you were born here?
Yes, I was born, I think, at Calvary Hospital in North Adelaide, and my parents were living in the Campbelltown area at the time.
Right. I was born. And your parents' full names?
My father was Charles Ramsay Emery.
Right.
And my mother's maiden name, she was Beryl Mary Dalton. They both came from the area. She came from Paradise, so he married a local girl.
And when were they born?
Dad was born in 1922 and Mum was born in 1924.
All right, thank you. Brian?
Brian David Emery, born on the 13th of April 1943 at Calvary Hospital.
And your parents?
Edward Robert Emery, more known as Bob, and he was born on the 1st of May 1904, and Nellie Veronica Whelan, who was born on the 31st of March 1906. Dad was born in Broken Hill, Mum was born in Kent Town, Adelaide. And Dad came down to school and lived at Joslin, and then when he and Mum got married, they moved to Athelstan at the death of our grandfather.
Right, thank you. And Paul?
Paul James Emery, born the 23rd of July 1941. I'm third one of the brothers.
Right, so how many brothers are there?
Six.
Six brothers, okay. Well, we'll hear a bit more about your side of the family in a moment. So, Margaret, you've got the records of when the Emerys first came to Australia and some of that history. Would you like to tell us about the family coming to Australia and taking up market gardening?
Yes, sure. Well, we're descended from a couple that came to South Australia from West Sussex in 1839, so quite early in South Australian history. They were a John and Elizabeth Emery, and they'd married in a small town in West Sussex at the end of 1838, in late November 1838, and early December they sailed from England for South Australia on a ship called the Buckinghamshire, which is quite a large ship, and they'd applied for free passage through the South Australia Company, and they arrived at Glenelg in March 1839. And they, he was in his early 30s, about 33, but and came from an agricultural family, probably mainly sheep farming in Sussex. And Elizabeth was only 18, and it seems as though she'd been a domestic servant to the Emery family there. But they arrived, and she was probably illiterate. She'd marked her marriage certificate and then later her will with a cross rather than signing it. So, but they had five sons between 1839 and 1847. So there was John was the oldest of those, and Robert, who was our great grandfather, was the youngest of those sons. So, but in that Robert was born in 1847. But only a couple of months after he was born, his father, John, died. So his mother was left at age of 25 with five sons under eight, and the youngest of them only a couple of months old. And by that time, they were in the Torrens Valley. So sometime in those early 1840s, they had taken up land on the, not on the Campbelltown side of the river, but on the Gillis Plains side of the river. And they were on section 508, which was north of the river, but just east of Darley Road. And it was part of a property that later became known as Beef Acres. So it was a name that became known in the area. But that property, and they leased some other nearby sections too. So they were farming over quite an area, but it was broadacre farming rather than market gardening at that stage. The John Emery had had a business as a stock agent and a dealer, stock dealer, as well as those agricultural properties. So, but he died intestate, and Elizabeth had to cope with quite a lot, I think, after he died. But she stayed on the land. She leased some more land at Dry Creek around 1850, and they moved on to a nearby section 503, which was at Gillis Plains in 1857, and she bought that land in the 1870s. And that property, it came to be known as Torrensford, although I don't think it was known as Torrensford while they were living there, but you can find information about the Torrensford name later on. And the house on that property is actually still there in a street called Lagonda Drive in Windsor Gardens, so there is a remnant of their life at that stage still there. But the two oldest... The oldest son and one of the others both went and worked on station properties and didn't stay on the land. There was one, George, who seemed to have been afflicted by illness and died at a fairly young age in 1870. But Richard, the second son, and Robert, the youngest, our great-grandfather, did go on to work on that land as they grew up. And we've got some information from Robert's diary from 1867, when he would have been about 20, and they talk a lot about reaping and winnowing and carting wheat, so it was still very much broadacre farming. But Elizabeth died in 1892, and it wasn't long after that that they lost that property, because I think there was a depression in the 1890s. There could have been a combination of reasons, but they couldn't service the debt, and they lost that property. But the family did continue market gardening interests in Campbelltown, because by then they had acquired some interests there, so... I can go on and talk bit about how that sort of came about.
Do you know whereabouts in Campbelltown
there were two parcels of land in Campbelltown that were involved quite early, and one was on the corner of Lower North East Road and Ann Street, part of section 310. The sections are set out quite well in the book about Campbelltown history by Elizabeth Warburton, but it's a sort of easy way of referring to the land. And another parcel with that bit was about 6 acres in total, but there was another section of 17 acres which was on the Torrens. And it was where Junction Road it didn't quite go down to the river, but they were off Junction Road towards the river, so not that far from Ann Street, but with river frontage. So, but the land on the corner of Ann Street and Lower North East Road came because Robert Emery married a Blanche Hancock, and her father, John Hancock, had a store and a garden on that corner, but he'd died before they married, so Robert and Blanche went to live on that garden property and on Lower North East Road. So that bit of land came via his marriage to Blanche Hancock. The other parcel came because the oldest son, John Emery, who'd been on station country for most of his life, bought that block in the 1880s when that area was sold in smaller parcels, and built a house on it in 1885. And it came into the... He didn't have children. Robert was the only one of them who had children. So he that land eventually came to Robert, and my grandfather was the youngest of Robert's sons. Paul and Brian's grandfather was the oldest son of that family. Cool. And so, but the youngest son, my grandfather, was the one who actually stayed on the land. Paul and Brian will talk about their grandfather, but he went off the land and had a career in the mining area before he bought land later in the area. But the land eventually came to my grandfather, and then it came down to my father and his two brothers, mm-hmm. who continued to garden there through the 1950s until the end of the 1950s.
Okay. Do you know what the family were growing, what sorts of things over those times?
I know that I know more about what they were growing when I was a child. Mm-hmm. Paul might actually know a bit more about some of the things that they were growing a little bit earlier. Mm-hmm. But they ended up growing potatoes in the summer and cauliflowers in the winter as their major two crops. But I can remember small quantities of watermelons and rock melons and trombones, and they certainly grew onions in the 1940s. They weren't growing onions that I remember, but they were growing onions in the 1940s. And on the Sydenham block there were a lot of orange trees. They grew cabbages, they grew trombones there, and they grew a variety of things, I think, there.
So the Sydenham block, is that the 17 acres?
Yes, that is the 17 acres. Sorry, it was known as Sydenham. That area was known as Sydenham. They always talked about the Ann Street block and the Sydenham block. And they moved, my dad and his brothers moved between those two blocks. Yes,
So, Paul, do you know any more of the history of what was grown early on?
I think Margaret's probably covered Sydenham pretty well. I can tell you what was growing sort of when we started in 1936. Pretty well, Uncle Bill was doing the marketing, so I suppose he sort of had a certain amount of line. When we started in, Uncle Bill ran it because Grandpa was up in, still in Broken Hill.
So is this the Sydenham property?
No, this is Athelstan I've been talking about.
Okay, so perhaps if we stay Sydenham and Ann Street to start with.
What Margaret said would be pretty right. But they experimented a lot, didn't they?
Yeah. I think they
tried.
Small quantities of things.
Yeah.
They tried, and then if something seemed to be successful, and they would, go with a bit more of that. There are some photos of... a whole lot of tomato plants. They must have tried that at some stage, but in my memory they weren't growing tomatoes at all. We used to be given tomatoes from some of the Italians who were growing tomatoes around and didn't grow tomatoes. But there's... they certainly grew carrots a bit, that I can remember them talking about growing carrots a bit. Yes, so, but my memories really of the marketing of things were of them, you know, harvesting potatoes and them being bagged and going to market, and loads of cauliflowers, some of which went to the East End market, but some of which were taken to the Rosella Pickle Factory on, I'd say North Terrace Botanic Road. I can't remember what the road was called, but...
And they made piccalilli.
Well, yes, they made green cauliflower pickle. It was quite... the smell was quite strong when you went into the factory. Yeah. It was in huge vats. I don't know, it's one of those funny childhood memories. You just remember going there. I remember the smell and I remember this huge sort of a bright yellowy-green colour of whatever they put into the pickles.
So from your childhood, were they working both Ann Street and Sydenham?
And Sydenham, yes. My dad used to go... my parents, when they married in 1948, moved into the house that was on the Sydenham block, but they only lived there for 2 years, and they contracted to build a house on the Ann Street block. They must have arranged for two house titles to be separated off from the market gardening land there, and they built a house, and we moved there in 1951, and then my dad was going on a kind of... we used to call it a putt-putt, a motorbike, between Ann Street and the Sydenham block. And the major production came from the Sydenham block, but they grew stuff on the Ann Street block as well.
So in your childhood, it was mainly potatoes. And were there a range of potatoes, varieties?
Yes, there were white and red potatoes. Mm-hmm. Please don't ask me the names of the varieties again. Paul might have more.
Well, there's Hextons and Sequoias.
Pontiacs.
They're the red ones, yes.
Yes.
I don't know if they grew Kennebec, but, you know.
They might have grown Kennebec. Sebago's are one.
Sebago's, yes.
One I remember.
Sebago was a good crop of years. Okay. Kennebec could be affected by the wind, you know, the tops were... So they're a bit touchy. Yeah, but Sebago was a... good solid one. Exton, a bit more earlier one, but Exton and Sebago were probably the main they would have been growing.
So,
you have memories of that potato cropping and bagging?
Yes, I do. And sewing up the bags of potatoes. And
so, were you involved in that sewing up the bags?
We were too young, really. I was there until I was 12, and so I guess by the time I was like 10 to 12, maybe we got to do bits and pieces. I guess they were the sorts of things we'd get out of if we could. Like, there might have been hoeing, weeding. We got involved a bit in the watering, because they used to watered from a bore, and they ran water down a canvas channel alongside the ends of the rows, and they'd fold the canvas to feed the water into a row, leave it running along the row for a certain amount of time till it watered the whole row, and then you'd have to shift the canvas, take it to the next row, prevent it from going to the watered row, and take it to the following row. And I do remember this, you know, having to organise that, or, like, you know, being told to watch it and change the watering, and just going with Dad to turn on and off the pump and those kinds of things. So,
and being generations of market gardeners and farmers, I imagine there would have been initially mainly by hand, and then possibly some animals, and then into the mechanisation. Do you remember any of those changes?
Well, they certainly still had horses at Sydenham when I was very young, but they had, I can remember that they used tractors by the time, you know, obviously in that 50s. I don't know, tractors would have come in well before that, I think, Paul, in the 1930s.
Yeah, there was always tractors around. They had early days of big old heavy ones.
Mm.
After the war, they brought in lighter ones with rubber tyres that were more suited. You know, they could do the row crop work before. I mean, you had big tractors to plough the ground up, but you had horses, because of their light feet, would go through and, you know, scarify and, you know, try and keep the weeds down in your different crops like cauliflowers, you know, sort of the cabbage and anything where you could sort of, you know, were sort of about 2 foot six or so apart. So, you know, I mean, onions and that which were planted, you know, close, you know, you couldn't get through, you had to hoe it.
Mm. And I imagine the soils were clay soils, were they?
Yes.
So that would have made it difficult for tractors in winter.
Yes, that's right. It could make it difficult for tractors in winter. But it was, I think it was, what Paul says, the scale of the operation, certainly at Ann Street where our house backed onto the garden, the scale of the operation was such that they couldn't do, there was a lot they couldn't do with tractors really, and quite a bit of it still had to be by hand. But it was...
Yes. We sort of had more areas, and they, you know, along the river you'd have flats and behind sheds and all these that weren't really conducive, you know, to big machinery. There's a lot of handwork, wasn't there?
Yes.
And that's probably like a river flat, you'd put, you know, trombones or something like that, that, you know. I know we grew them down on the river flat.
Mm.
Sort of beans or peas you'd have sort of in a smallish area. But, you know.
Mm. So given fairly intensive agricultural practices, did your family employ other workers?
Yes, they did employ other workers. They employed blokes to do various things. There were, well, my the dad and his two brothers, you know, worked with my grandfather, so there were sort of three of them and my grandfather, but they certainly employed other workers. Again, Paul knows a bit more about that, I think, because there was a bit of cooperation between my family and his family when I was, well, even before I was born, probably, I think, and they were working out things between them, and they had labourers that maybe worked for both families. And we were just talking about the fact that my dad and his brothers, or one of his brothers, worked for Paul's family when they were quite young, maybe, you know, 14 to 16, they're listed in his...
I remember in that era they left school a lot earlier than...
Yes, probably, yes, that's right.
Got to prime, you know, year seven, and that was it, I would think, in a lot of cases.
Our dad kept meticulous diaries from 1936 to 42, and every night he entered every job that the workers did during
Fantastic.
The day in that booklet. And
what a great record.
Yeah, and there was lots of times that, and of course, our grandfather died in 33, but Dad and Mum didn't get married till the end of 1935, so Dad didn't sort of arrive at Athelstan until 1936. So Uncle Bill, Margaret's grandfather, ran the property, and he had a person that was a very good manager, Harry White. So, and Harry used to and fro from Sydenham to Athelstan and looked after Athelstan quite a lot. And if you were busy with onions and that, you had to have a lot of people, and therefore Charlie, Max and Doug, who were Margaret's father and two uncles at that stage, Paul said, the first record I've got is about, they were about 14, they were top and tailing onions, and then they would go down to Sydenham. Dad would say, somebody went down to Sydenham to do the top and tailing. So as the onions came ripe to cut, they would transverse between properties.
Mm-hmm.
And Dad, before he got married, was working at Harris Scarf, so he hadn't really had that, being, you know, born Broken Hill. So he certainly needed, Uncle Bill more or less sort of ran it, through his manager, Harry White. And eventually Harry stayed with Dad, more or less once he got married. Harry stayed more or less on the Athelstan property and ran it right through for even, through my time he was still,
right.
Ran the show. Eventually nothing was said, but I think he gradually put the, more or less, the, for us about time we stepped up and did it, but he still worked on with us then.
A handover.
Yeah.
So your family were on the sort of the original properties, and how long did they keep those properties?
They kept those until the late 1950s. I don't know exactly what happened about the Ann Street property or how it was disposed of, but the Sydenham property was subdivided at the end of the 1950s. Dad and his brothers had been wanting to get out of market gardening for a while and go broadacre farming, and Dad started to acquire some property down in the southeast, and they sort of planned a gradual move. So the younger two moved down there first, and Dad's family was the last one to stay up here and see that subdivision through. And I think while that land, after it was subdivided, Dad either worked for other people or share farmed some land somewhere with other people for a while. And we moved out at the end of 1961. By that time, that land had been sold and they'd bought enough land in the southeast to start broadacre farming. So
the land, when it was subdivided, was that subdivided for housing or was there still some market gardening? Or?
No, that 17 acres on the Torrens was subdivided for housing, and the Ann Street was subdivided for housing as well. Whatever happens, if you look at it now, that is all housing. I've got the sort of advertising that was done of the house blocks, so you can sort of see how it was divided up at the time. The house that was the 1885 house that was on it and that had been my grandparents' and where I had my first 2 years, that was just demolished because it didn't fit into the division up into blocks. It was smack in the middle of the property and in an inconvenient place, so it was just bowled over. But yes, it was subdivided for housing, and they had to give part of the river frontage for what's become the linear park now. So in that subdivision there was already kind of a provision for a green space along the river. So
they were growing right to the river?
Yes, they did grow right to the river.
Actually, the properties in those days, you owned half the river.
To the centre of the river.
Yeah.
And my dad would say that was interesting because the centre of the river could actually move a bit.
Yes.
The river course changed somewhat over time, and so there could be some interesting...
That happened down at Sydenham.
Yes, it did.
There was a sort of dog leg. And one big flood, I think Pittman's were on the other side, it cut straight through. And so Bill Emery managed to gain that bit of ground because that was then he had to the middle of the river.
Wouldn't have made your neighbours happy.
No, it was all right if you were on the winning side. Not if you were on the losing side. Yeah. So,
I imagine there was a fairly strong market gardening community of families. Do you have any memories of those other families near you?
I have memories of other families near us. We had, there were quite a lot of Italian families living around us when I was a kid. Ann Street didn't have heaps of houses in it. It was much more a country environment than a suburban or city environment. Although it was gradually changing, but we had Italian, we used to call him Mr. Sam, a couple down the road, their name was Coppolecchio, and Dad used to let him grow some vegetables alongside our house. He mustn't have had enough land. He was, well, as I remember it, quite elderly at the time and not, I think, working on any broad scale, but he liked to grow things like eggplants and things that my mum was very suspicious about and didn't want to really. She had fairly conservative food taste. There was a family called Ciotti, but I think they were builders who lived on the corner of Chapel Street near us. But Dad was a friend with a fellow called Johnny D'Angelica, who was he was a market gardener, and he worked with Dad. I think he might have worked for Dad at some stage, but I can remember visiting his place somewhere near on or near Darley Road when I was a kid. And certainly families like Pitts and Packers and, quite a number of families.
And were there social occasions when the Market Garden families got together at all?
I don't think as such, not as market gardening families getting together. We got together with families, I guess, that were friends of Mum and Dad and who weren't necessarily, they might have come from market gardening backgrounds. There was a family called Heading that was, a fellow was a mate of Dad's, and also a fellow called Laurie Brown who'd he'd married a girl whose name was Mole and who'd come from the area, but he himself was from Victoria and had come here when the war was on. People were billeted here when the war was on, and some of them met girls and married them, and he married her. So we got together with those families, but I can't remember market gardening gatherings as such,
except
maybe when you went to the market and, you know, that just get together as...
They might have breakfast or something.
Yeah, we can remember having breakfast or, you know, talking to people at the market, but not as a, you know, not Mum and Dad as a social couple.
Well, they worked Dad. Long hours, didn't they? And they worked for 5 days, plus they worked at dinner time, 12 o'clock they used to knock off, and, Sunday morning, like when we're church goes back in those...
Yes, that's true.
Pretty well. Yeah.
So they probably socialised at the various churches they went to and got to know them.
I can remember Dad was a bit friendly with some people that he perhaps traded, like sold vegetables to. There was possibly people, don't even know exactly, but who had fruit and veg shops that they maybe sold to, and there was a couple called Ern and Carlene Taddeo that... they had a place at Kensington Gardens and a tennis court, and Mum and Dad used to go and play tennis there, and so we'd all go there sometimes on weekends, and they certainly socialised with them. That's one family I could remember.
Well, Uncle Bill, he was very friendly with a chap up the river, Gus Lockett, who grew oranges, didn't he? And he used to go fishing.
Yes.
I suppose that was a bit of, you know, a waste of time. Yeah, it was.
And there was a fellow at Wakery, I presume, again, had a shop. He had some area that was used for roller skating up there. So I can remember Dad coming home with discarded roller skates that were presumably no longer any good for him to use, but bringing both me and my sister roller skates back. That was, you know, from this bloke that he must have been friendly enough to get them from.
So the Italian neighbourhood, were they reasonably newly arrived families post-war, or were they longer term, do you know?
Some of them were certainly longer term. I think that Mr. Sam, the Coppolecchio, had come before the war, but some of them could well have been post-war. The D'Angelicas were here pre-war because
definitely some, you know, because Harry always talked about, you know, back, you know, in the 30s and that, not big numbers, but the majority came sort of
after
late 40s, wasn't it?
Yes.
50s, yeah. Mm. But there was, you know, Italian people.
Yeah. And It probably wasn't until the late 50s and 60s that they started the Australians or gardeners, the younger ones that were coming through the broad acre, that wasn't enough land, and they were selling land out of Virginia, so they sort of selling the land here and going out to big acres and growing big crops. And a lot of the Italians, that's when they started buying property up around about that time, Paul.
A lot of it, you know, they worked two jobs when they'd come out initially. I mean, you need money to buy land, and some they'd work, say, Holden's or one of these, and then they would do work 4 hours or so a morning's work on a market garden. And of course, then they, you know, picked up the skills. So when they got enough money, then they bought these smaller blocks and that, and that's how they really came in. And, you know, they virtually took, you know, Campbelltown's big Italian property.
But there was obviously trading amongst the families, because you talked about the tomatoes from some of your neighbours and the oranges and so on.
Yeah. I mean, later on we can go through who were there when we were growing up, but then the Mercurellas were both sides, and we had Parker brothers wouldn't bring the bread down to our place down the road, so we had a bread box up the top, and, you know, often the Mercurellas would drop some goods off there, or we'd drop them over the fence, you know, sort of.
Yes, I had a very good relationship.
That strong sense of community.
Yeah, and a lot of swapping of, you know, there was always, I think, swapping of some
goods. If you had, you're growing carrots and beetroot or whatever, not celery, well, you know, you'd
the sharing
to feed the tables
for your table.
So before we go on to the Athelstan property, is anything else about the Sydenham and Ann Street property or your memories you'd like to share?
I think I've probably covered most of the things that I thought might be interesting. I think life in general was, perhaps Brian was mentioning a bit, there was still a lot of deliveries. It was like bread delivered, the box was left out with the money in it on the front porch. Milk was delivered.
In the saucepan.
Well, yes, and later bottles. we still had groceries delivered on a weekly basis, and my grandfather had married a Ramsay from Ramsay's shop at Paradise, and so our groceries got delivered still from Ramsay's shop at Paradise. So trams still ran along Lower North East Road, so when I first started school it was a tram ride.
And where did you start school?
We went to into the city to school, to St. Aloysius College, my sister and I. My mum was a Catholic and my dad had agreed that we would be brought up Catholic, so that's where we went to school. So we caught the tram into the city to school for primary school years. Yes. So.
And then you moved to the southeast as a young teenager?
I started high school, yes, and but we moved down there and we went to the local public schools down there. So after there'd been a bit of a debate about whether we would be left up here to go to boarding school, to keep going to a Catholic school, but we actually went to the local schools down there. So, yes, I was 12 going on 13 when we moved down there, so... The other delivery man I remember coming was the Rawleys man, still used to come, and Mum bought vanilla essence, and I think there were sort of medical things that they bought as well.
Well, they had a couple of ointments, didn't they?
Yes, they did.
Magic salve, and then the one that you...
Balm, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Magic balm.
Oh, they still sell it?
Yes, they do, yes.
Actually, while we're on this, I've got a bit there. You know, after the 40s, I mean, the Adelaide suburbs virtually stopped at Payne, and it was all market gardens. And, I know our first doctor we went was Dr. Riley, was down in Payne, and the dentist was at Payne. Jeff Barthold, the chemist, he was down at Evandale on the corner there of Pateville Road. Butcher, well, I think the market man would get the meat at Cheek, V.O. Cheek, right down near Harrow Road, right down there at St. Peter's. And then Chaff Merton with Kieran's, you know, on at Royston Park. So, and it was basically out our way, there was, well, A.J. Stocker was on the corner of, and
Ann
Street, and of course Ramsey's and Sons, who were at the Paradise Terminus. They were bakers originally, weren't they? And,
yes, it was a bakery, a grocery store, and mixed.
And we had home deliveries, we had ice, we don't know who that was, but newspaper, and Mr. White used to, he had a motorbike and a sidecar. The sidecar was a big grey box. Mm. He used to come, and Brett was Mr. Harvey, who actually had a horse and a van. He came, that was Ramsey's Brett. Milk was Mr. Arthur, and Rory's Leo Slattery. And public transport, you had to go down to Paradise to catch the tram, or there's a bus, Lang, so you used to go up the Gorge Road to Athelstan.
We used to ride our bikes down to Ramsey's and park our bikes in the old horse stables at Ramsey's, and then hop on the tram. And we went to Allengown about 1950, St. Joseph Allengown there for a couple of years, so we used to catch a tram there, or if we went to the, later years ago, the cricket, used to catch a tram into town, but we always rode our bikes, had to park at Ramsey's.
The old mile and a quarter we were from the tram stop. We really didn't go up to Atherston, we saw it.
And was your mail delivered, or was there not a local postal route?
No, it wasn't in those days, and we were actually living in Athelstan. Schultz Road was the boundary between Paradise, but because all our travel was to markets and whatnot, Dad addressed the mail, George Street, Paradise. So Ramsey's had the post office as well, but did a lot. But so when we were coming back from market, or when Dad was coming back from market, or to Rosella or Mile End, Goodyards or whatever, he'd call in. And if we were, Paul and I with him, we often got a Torspa drink, which is like a creaming soda. Mm. And Dad would pick the mail up, so it was handy. Otherwise, you would have had to journey up to Athelstan to pick it up to the Athelstan post office. So that's...
Yeah, well, Torspa was the factory down at Payne West Sweeps. I think it's been, you know, just near over OG Road,
So your the three of your childhoods, it was a fairly rural community.
Definitely semi-rural. Yeah, almost rural.
So it was like growing up in the country, not growing up in a suburb of Adelaide.
More country-like than city-like. There was a lot of space around you, and
People often say that I talk like a country boy, but I don't know if I sound like that or not.
And us riding the bike, from Athelstan to Paradise, we knew all the names of the people, but we always waved them, or they waved us. And, you know, it was Nichols, Lucas, Donaldson, Clark, Silks, Enright,
Leesing, Connors, and
a really strong sense of community. You knew your neighbours.
Harris is on the other side, wasn't
Your heritage, Brian and Paul, your father, your great-grandfather left the original land.
Grandfather. The Robert Emery, the great-grandfather who married Blanche Hancock, Margaret and I believe he moved in pretty well when he got married, and the eldest daughter was Ida Elizabeth, and our grandfather was the eldest son and the second born, Cyril John Emery, and he was born at the Ann Street property in 19th of December 1875. And he went to school and he finished it. He went to St. Peter's for his higher education. I don't know what that was, but he...
Is that something in those days, though?
Yeah. He went to work for a stockbroker in 92, and then in 96 he moved to Broken Hill as a timekeeper. And then
So, excuse my ignorance, yes. What's a timekeeper?
I assume that he did the wages or clock people in and out, you know, did that sort of... history just says he was a timekeeper, started off
people
as a timekeeper.
Clock on and clock off. Yeah.
And was that at the Broken Hill mine?
And he started at the British mines in Broken Hill. And then he became the accountant there, and then 1912 he was the manager of British mines. And then British mines were bought out by North Broken Hill later. And he remained as manager of British Mines, and then when North Broken Hill, the manager retired there, he then became manager of North Broken Hill and the British Mines.
So your father was born in Broken Hill?
Was born in Broken Hill. So our grandfather, Cyril John, married Catherine Mary Jones, and she was in 1900, and they had four children. Else was Auntie Eileen in 1901. Our dad was 1904. His brother Cecil was 1906, and another sister Mary in 1908. And so they did their primary schooling in Broken Hill. But in 1919, he bought a property at Joslin.
Grandfather
bought a property at Joslin. And our grandmother moved down.
With
the four children to finish off their higher education, and it was also he was looking at retiring. Mm-hmm. There.
He was always sort of
going to come back to Adelaide. So in 1933, he corresponded with all these children very regularly. And we've got our cousin Peter, who is Cecil's only son, has got letters from Grandpa in 1921, where he, as the manager of the British mines, he took a tour over to England to present himself to the AGM for the British mines was held in. London each year, so this year they asked him to come over and present himself or whatever, he did. And then we've got all these letters where he's decided to, he was 50 about, 33, so he's about 56 at this stage, and he's looking at retiring when he's 60, and he's looking at buying a property or a couple of properties in Adelaide to retire to. And this Uncle Bill, who is his youngest brother, and has got the working the market gardens, is looking out for a suitable property for him. And he often travelled by train from Broken Hill down to Adelaide, and they'd go out and look at a property. And Athelstan bobbed up, and Uncle Bill said, "Oh, there's a property at Athelstan that is reasonably priced because it was a mortgagee sale." And so Cyril said he'd come down. So he came down, and Uncle Bill, and he looked at it, and he purchased that property in 1933. And as we know the history then, Bill and Harry White sort of operated in that time. But our grandfather ran all the finer details, and all the... The house was pretty derelict, wasn't it, Paul?
Yeah, the place was run down.
Yeah.
And what size property was it?
16.5 acres.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's one of on the river, which is the handy with the water.
And was that what was the exact location of that property?
It was on the corner of Lower Athelstan Road and Schultz Road, mm-hmm. And that Schultz Road is now River Drive.
Section 805,
Lot 9.
So is that the western side or the eastern side of Schultz Road?
It's the eastern side.
Schultz Road was originally called Boundary Road. We're on the Athelstan side, and the Western side is paradise.
Wow.
Yeah, I think it's called Paradise Park or Paradise, going out some fancy name. But
And that stretched from that corner down to the river?
Yes, it's a fairly long property. It was twice as wide as at Lower Atherston Road, and one of the boundaries that sort of came in. It was fairly narrow by the time we got down
to the river.
And
we had a river flat, but it went up very steep.
Yes, we had a real steep, we had a steep, very steep embankment. Well, the pump from to the pump up to the top of the cement tank, the water was 160 feet, so there was, and I reckon the bank would have been about 100 feet or so, wouldn't it?
It was
very dangerous, really, and sort of shale rock and that,
So your father...
So Dad was working at Harris Scarves, and then Grandpa died on the 16th of July 1934, so it was still being run by Uncle Bill and Harry. But Dad was married on the 29th of October 1935, and then he and Mum went to live at Athelston, and then Dad finished with Harris Scarves and became a market gardener. So,
and he hadn't had much experience of market gardening at that point?
No, I think just growing vegetables at home was...
I think probably the grandfather had an orchard out the back, and that is still sort of, you know, up at Broken Hill, even, you know, he drew fruit trees and stuff, it was sort of...
So, we always say that the farming and marketing is in the blood, like there's people that have got that there... I didn't have it, but, you know, Paul, I'm sure all the two. Yeah. And
it's in the gene pool.
It's in the gene pool, that's right,
So they moved onto the property, and you said it was fairly derelict at that time?
Yes, it had a ball pump and a black tank, which wasn't all that, was about 4 or 5 feet, and it didn't hold a lot of water. It was very, it sort of had a metal around it, and I think they'd plastered the concrete up. It had chicken wire inside, so it was only fairly thin, but so you wouldn't have wanted to put too much, but they had a steel rod around it to hold it together. But yes, it didn't really have any outer buildings, did it? You didn't say about the red shed was the first building they...
That's right, So Grandpa was on the go, and he writes to Cecil and says our first cousin, we'll call him New Guinea Bob Emery, because our dad and him had the same name, Bob. So
and he went to New Guinea in the late 30s.
So he said he wasn't doing any work at that stage, but he was pretty handy with his hands. So the house was fairly derelict, and so he got him to patch that up, get it livable, and he also asked him to build a shed, and then we've got the red shed, and the red shed was a wonderful shed, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But Cecil worked for Elder Smith, and he had the...
this is the youngest.
Dad's brother, and so he was able to get a lot of timber, and was very good at, measuring up and that sort of thing, because that was his part of his living. So he measured up a red shed, and New Guinea Bob built the red shed. So
and red because it was painted that
painted
colour?
Red, yeah. And we had a celery shed which was built of old bitumised tins, and that was a sort of a black shed, but we called that the celery shed, but it was a sort of a working shed. But, we had names. Now, the red shed had a through at the front where you could come from Shorts Road and drive straight through up the garden, but it also had stables in there, had a loft where we stored things, and
there's bags
another area where the workers could sit and have lunch and that sort of thing. So,
it was kind of like the office, the part of the...
Where you started the day, and as youngsters, Dad would head off to work, and he'd probably have two or three of us hanging on, and we'd go into the shed and, they'd talk about what they were going to do for the day, and then they'd head off and we'd head back to the house. But it was just a sort of a ritual, as I said, when we were young, even when we were at school and whatnot, during the holidays we would go over and spend a lot of time, talking, even at lunchtime, we'd have lunch and slip over and talk to the workers, you know, while they were having lunch and drinking their Woody's a bottle of black tea, cold black tea, you know.
Screw top.
So that's what, you know, that's what they drank, you know. They just, they had their lunch and have this, yeah, flask of...
Full bottle of...
black tea, yeah.
So your parents moved on to the property when they first married, so you were all born...
Yes, at Athelstan.
At Athelstan?
Yes.
Well, Calvary.
From birth you...
Yeah, yeah.
And you said there are six brothers?
Yes.
And no sisters?
No.
So Cyril was born in 1936, mm-hmm. August, and then Robert was 1939, Paul 1941, I was 43, Roger 46 and Bill 49.
Right. Yeah. And so you were growing up on the land, you had cousins and so on nearby.
That's right.
So what are your early memories of, childhood memories of working on there?
School holidays, that's how we spent, once we were old enough to do anything, we'd sort of...
But we enjoy it.
Our main thing was that we used to enjoy the truck rides, how they used to take the loads down to Mile End or to go into the market and that type of thing.
Hitch a lift.
I think Dad liked the company. Well, he might have got a couple out of Mum's.
Giving her a rest.
Mum was probably disappointed he could only fit two or three.
So in your childhood, what were you growing on that land?
Well, I've got 1930s. Just one thing, one big problem also on the property, where it was had a weed called Convolvulus, or Burbine was its common name.
Mm-hmm.
It was green with a white flower and had a fair bit of root system, and that they had to plough. The only way then was to cultivate it out, so they had bad patches out, so they would plough and then they'd skim and harrow. Dad had diaries from 36 to 41, and always at some stage someone was either skimming or ploughing or doing, they were using horses too that day, so... Mm-hmm.
And you said it was a fairly derelict property. So had it been a market garden before, or did they have to clear it?
Trees.
I know in the Dad's 1936 diary, they were, you know, grubbing out a lot of trees. I know they down the river flat and sort of get more land, you know, near the creek and that. Crops getting back with that, growing with that, potatoes, onions, celery, cabbage, cauliflower, sweet melons, watermelon, trombone, tomatoes, sweet corn, lettuce, beetroot and beans.
Mm-hmm.
So I would think they would probably... we had a fair bit of black base by a Biscay soil, which is very heavy, and it would have been much different to the Campbelltown soil, which, you know, you had a bit of sand and sort of red clay and that. So they would have been experimenting what they could grow. So I think the following year they dropped out, they were back to, that was 13, they dropped back to 11 the next year. And, they had, in 36 they put an electric motor onto the bore, so I think it must have been sort of powered by, a fuel sort of driven motor before that. But the bore wasn't anything outstanding, it only put up about 1,800 gallons an hour, which... I think it dropped back after that. There's, I think a lot blamed the earthquake back in 1954. A lot of sort of, you know, that earthquake was heavy and it even sent it, made it a bit more salty too, but getting ahead of myself a bit there. So they certainly went in for celery. That year they planted 67,000 celery plants, so it was sort of a crop that they must have, you know, had their eyes on, and the celery industry was really going places even back in those days. There was a comment from the grandfather forecast that in his last letter that he thought celery would be the crop to make money out of in the future, so he got that right.
Because they're world famous for celery in this area.
Yes,
it was, yeah. And they had their own varieties. I know Harry White said, 1922, Harold Smith was growing celery there on Daly Road in Paradise. And the big beauty about celery was that you could plant on that same ground every year. Uh-huh. Whereas, say, your potatoes and cabbage, you had to do a rotation. So, yeah. And the black ground, it was terrible soil in the winter, but as long as you had the drainage, midwinter was very good. It wasn't so good for early celery right to late, but it certainly, but it was hard going, believe you me, working in that. It's very movable soil. You get cracks, very wide. And there's a story that one of the workers, in the early days, rather than if they caught it for lunch, and rather than go right down the river, stop the bore, and then come for lunch, he just turned the water into a great big crack. Went and had his lunch, come back, the water was still going down the crack, and he just turned his lettuce back onto his canvas back onto the crop. But the cracks were 2 or 3 inches wide, and then you just saw the mud in the winter, but hard going.
And you said there were a range of varieties of celery. Do you know any of the names of any of those?
Well, basically there was an early, midwinter and late. Had fries, and it would have been other growers who sort of saved. They were open pollinated, so you save your own seed. So early we were growing fries, and then later Pearsons. In midwinter we had Clarks, and then we got we had a semi-late with Lucas Brothers, and then we had Packers and Mercurios. Yeah, we had all different sort of, but you'd get them from a neighbour, you probably would trade some. Each year you probably kept a different variety, you kept your own seed. And you also, you were 12 months with Sarah because you planted your own seedbed, which would have done that about the end of September, early October. And you plant those till about mid-January, and you'd start planting about the second week in January. That's transplanting out. And you transplant to about the end of April, roughly. And you'd cut from, say, beginning of April to about the first week in October. Though early, they used to stop about the first week in September. But I think the growers gradually extended the season.
And did you have glass houses for the seed raising?
No. We used to put them out in the open and cover them with horse manure originally. And we used to put a bit of sort of a very fine chicken wire over, because we used to get those gully winds and that would blow it off. So. But in time, the winds did win on, but you'd just, have to redo that the next morning. And we, plant them, ward them with a rose, hose and rose in those days. We also grew our own cabbage plants.
For seed?
We kept the seed. And there again, we had different varieties, Hughes and Nichols, and, you would sort of... Of course, you kept your own varieties. We developed one, our own, yes.
And the horse manure, was that from your own horses, or did you have to go and collect that?
Probably I would have had to buy some, I would think. We only had two horse stable. Smithy was there for... they got horses from Sydney, they used to bring them up. And back in 1934, Uncle Bill realised that they would need their own horse. So he got this... I think it was about a three-year-old, lovely-looking horse, black and white, bought it from Harris Scarf, and he arrived on this day, whenever it was, 1934. And they said, well, what was your name? Anyway, Kingsford Smith flew over the stage into Melbourne, and he's on his way to Parafield Aerodrome. We were on the flight path back in those days. So hence he was called Smithy. But he wasn't a great horse. Uncle Bill had a good horse called Dick. He'd worked in the railway yards, and he was easily the best ploughing horse. And in 1940, Smithy was by himself. In 1940, I think one day, it was a Saturday, Charlie Amber rode, they had ploughing doing next week, so Charlie rode Smith down to Camp Sydenham, picked up both Dick and Chunky and brought them back, and they did the ploughing that week. Anyway, they kept Chunky, and sort of Dick went back, and well, I'm sure Uncle Bill didn't want to part with him, and brought old Smithy back. So we had two there for a while, but all late 40s. When they used to knock off at Saturday, we had a padded on lower off Alciston Road and the Shulks Road, that top corner. They'd let them out in the, from the, you know, the stable and the red shed, and they'd there. But this day, Smithy, Chunky, gathered around like mad, and he just dropped dead. So, and so, yeah, Smithy was left, but then in 1948, we bought a Ford Ferguson tractor.
Just on the horse manure, our brother Robert has written a story about just after the war, fertiliser was in short supply, and to help our needs in this area, we began going to Hamley Bridge, some 88 kilometres away, and loading manure from a dairy farm on the edge of Hamley Bridge. Harry White and a workman and Cyril and Robert undertook this task. We had our first truck was in 1944, which was a Ford truck, and that had a speedometer that went up to 60 miles an hour. And according to the speedometer, this was top speed was often achieved. The Ford was an excellent product, and the model was purchased by many market gardeners. The tear of that truck was 3 tonne with the help of springs added, increasing carrying capacity to 5 tonne. On one return trip, weekend, not Saturday, from Hamley Bridge, it was decided to weigh the load, which registered 7 tonne 12 hundredweight, somewhat overloaded. The truck had no problems with the load. We would be in trouble with modern regulations.
They were called a lend-lease. They were sort of made for the army, but they weren't used for the army, and you sort of had to, you know, get a sort of apply for them, and the government would release them
to primary producers.
So that was really the first thing that Dad bought. He'd always used Uncle Bill's thing. So 44, we had our first truck, which, you know, there's about, I think Robert went through, we had about 18, I think it was 18 Fords, only about two Chevrolets in there. So there was a bit of competition. I know Henry Lorenz used to try and race them up the hill there, you know, you, coming from that board, then they used to have to come up that hill from Jeff's Cross up towards the jail.
Yeah, the jail.
And there'd be a bit of competition, you know, to see who had the best truck up that hill.
quite a hill carrying a load.
Well, so tell the story, poor Coventry's, one day they couldn't get up and they had an Austin. And Harry even hooked onto them and pulled them up the hill with our truck load, and off they went. But they're very, you know, and there was even pig manure they used to get, but it was a very short supply. You just couldn't get any of this, you know, blood and bone and certain, you know, the artificial fertilisers in that era.
Robert mentions the pig manure here too. He said we collected pig manure not far from Parafield Airport. And pig farms collected food scraps from the hotel dining rooms to feed the pigs, and we often found spoons and forks in the manure.
But the fowl manure, the horse manure, was the best for the seabeds because it had straw as well, which acted as a mulch, and then you had such a...
So I imagine, you know, my knowledge of gardening is that would need to be aged or rotted down, some of that manure.
Oh yes.
So they'd bring it home.
They put it in a heap.
Yeah. Mm. We used to do it in the horse paddock, and we'd drop it off in the horse paddock and put the there until it was ready to be spread out.
Yeah.
And then I guess that was done mainly by hand, was it?
Yes, I think in the, you can see them spreading manure here. Yeah.
It wouldn't have been the favourite job. No. You've mentioned horses, and then, of course, going and getting this other manure. Were there other animals on the properties?
We always had dogs. Do you want any dog stories?
If you've got a good dog story.
We've got a couple.
We had fowls,
No, tell Pat and Mick, those are the first.
You tell that one for me.
Pat and Mick, there was a stray cat coming one day, and Pat and Mick, the two dogs, they chased it up the telegraph pole out the front, you know, with a wooden pole. and they stood guard together under the pole, and whenever one got tired, the other one, one would take a break while the other one stayed. They kept this up for 2 or 3 days, but then one stepped in and sort of said, enough's enough. So the dogs were tied up, and I think the cat took a while to come down. We've never ever seen again. Also, you're going to say about Scotty?
We had a border collie, Kelpie, Scotty, and because we had a in the front part of the house there, we played cricket, and Scotty took to cricket like nothing on earth. He became the wicket keeper. Anything got past the batsman, he would catch or whatever, and then he'd run the ball back to the bowler, so drop the ball, race back and get behind the wicket, and it went on. And if he nicked the ball, he never missed a catch. And Roger, who was very good with all animals, he got to the stage where he would pick the ball up quickly and bowl before Scotty could get back. So Scotty fixed him up. He used to drop the ball 20 yards away from Roger and then run it. So that Roger had to come get it. And then we had him playing football. We didn't have actual footballs. We used to have old beach balls, or if the beach ball perished, we'd put paper in them and we'd throw him up and he'd jump up in the air and hit it with his head. And
he'd be the ruckman.
He'd be the ruckman against, Roger or I. And then it didn't matter which end it was. He always knew where the goals were, and he'd always, if he bounced along, he'd knock the ball and knock it with his head, and knock it through the goals. So
he was the seventh brother, wasn't he?
But if the tractor started up, he was gone. No matter, he was that sheepdog in him. As soon as the tractor, if he heard it anywhere, he would just disappear, and he would circle the tractor, and as soon as it got started, he certainly wouldn't run around it all day.
Yeah.
And Spot was another one that we had. Mr. Harvey, that used to drop the groceries or the bed off and
bread,
and he used to walk up the path, and Mum would come out and he'd drop the groceries off and we'd be holding Spot. Because Mum would say, don't let the dog out, so we'd be holding. And then we'd wait till Mr. Harvey got almost down the path, and then Mum say, you could let him go. And, of course, he'd race up and he'd always catch him, and he'd have the bread basket sort of... And
drag
it eventually drag Spot off, but I don't know whether it's Mum's entertainment or not. But
a couple of dogs used to get the paper and Tyke... Mum, he'd bring the paper up from the front and drop it, and Mum would always give him something, to eat. But then he got overzealous. He used to go and get the neighbour's papers. And then Nipperville, he used to meet the paperman up the top of the... He was so keen up the top and right of Atherston Road, and he'd race the paper down. The paper man, he didn't have to come down to us. He'd just hold the paper and deliver it back to flying.
Delivery boy for him.
So we had quite a few dogs there.
And you said you had chickens as well. Were they just sort of for family use?
Well, there's a record in 1938 where they built the celery shed. Harry White and workers did all that. And at the same time, they built a fowl house, which we had an outside toilet, which was about 20 yards from the... from the back of the house. We put the first fowl house there, and it was a reasonable size. We probably had how many fowls, you reckon?
Nearly 20 at some stage. We got smaller, so didn't have as many.
As the horses got less and less, because the top paddock was the horse paddock where they used to graze and that, we then put it across the creek, and it was there, and there was the cow, which I can't remember, but...
Yes, they had a cow. She had Molly, the cow.
Yeah, so that was there. And then I remember, might have been the late 40s, early 50s, there was a hell of a noise one night, and sort of Dad got up and had a look around. He said, I can't see anything, but all the fox had got in, and, of course, all the fowls were dead. So then we shifted up to the top of the...
Behind
the crate shed, which was just opposite the house. And that's That was there, wasn't it, until the finish.
So did you sell eggs? Or
no, just, just for the six family. Boys. We had a, you know, good baking.
Originally, we used to have bacon and eggs, didn't we?
Yeah.
But then eventually, as we got older, we helped us with our wheat picks or whatever. And we had a wood stove, so you toasted your own bread. But that was another story. I mean, as we got older, Mum used to be ready to me. I don't know what time we had breakfast, but lunch was at 12 and tea was right at 5 o'clock, they knocked off. And if you weren't there, you went hungry. Mum used to say, I'm not running a restaurant. So, so I don't think anyone ever went hungry.
And lots of fresh produce from the farm?
Yes.
Yeah, well, the onions, potatoes and cabbage and celery.
Plenty of that.
Yes, we had a go-to bill, the last one, he had a lot of problems, you know, with the allergies, you know, asthma, and I know what he didn't have, and he couldn't have dairy products, so we had to get a, buy a goat for him. He had Bella, she was, you know, fairly old, but, you know, Robert used to milk her, and, but anyway, they must have thought, well, they'll need it ongoing, so they made it a Bella with a wild one called... Oscar, that Hersey's had him from, and so then the offspring was Bella, was Pollyanna, and so well, I think I eventually took over, we milked Pollyanna, so yeah, we had to have, buy a goat for him.
So you took over from your father, is that right?
Yeah, well, Cyril was...
No, well, Harry was always basically the manager. Your dad, you know, unfortunately passed away in 1955. Now Cyril was the eldest, he wasn't quite 19, so Mum was left with virtually four at school and one who hadn't started. And but Cyril was in the garden.
So Cyril left about 14, so he would have been about 1952 or 51.
Yeah, something like
about
that.
About 52, he went into the garden.
Right.
Yeah.
And had other, it was a Stan Gribble was there, I know. Bill had ran in retirement.
No, he'd retired at that stage.
So then I went in the garden in 1957.
And so how old were you then?
15.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know what I was ever going to do then. Christmas and I thought, well, I've got to do so. So I'd go into the garden,
So you and Cyril took over the garden from
With Harry.
Harry ran it.
And Mum had to, poor old Mum had to do a lot of the paperwork and all that.
Mum had never ever done anything really. But Robert, he was starting to be an accountant, and he and Mum would go down to Uncle Bill. He coached them how to do all the
paperwork.
So they used to go down. It was about every fortnight.
Fortnight,
they went down to Uncle Bill's.
And I imagine your dad's very good records made it helpful on that transition.
Would have been. Her mum had never done it, of course. She'd been a telephonist before, so she never.
Even as you said, Grandpa, or great grandpa, he kept records too. We've only got a few, but it looks as though we're sort of something, and Uncle Bill probably had Dad sort of starting off. I remember our grandfather said to get a yearbook from someone under the two, Uncle Seth, so he was probably encouraging them to start keeping records of what they did, so that carried on.
His dad never had really great health. He had a rheumatic heart, so eventually, but he was sort of, he was all right, he was smoking. He had control of his weight. The mum said, well, once the children come, no smoking, but he sort of put on weight, and I think he ate instead of smoking. But he baffled, you know, he was on a diet and that. And we used to have this Prasera bread and all that, but I don't know.
So, hard work for someone with a heart condition.
So
he was only 51 anyway.
So you had worked the land then for how long?
Right through to 1992. Well, roughly, we finished about 91, but, you know, the property was sold in 92, so
Okay. So tell me a bit about that time from when, you know, you started working the land through to the 1990. What sorts of things? Were you changing what was growing?
Yes, I hope I can find my rep. We were growing, just, we cut back to 7 crops at that stage.
In the early days, my first memories are of carrots and beetroot, and the workers digging them out, you know, and then taking them down and squirting them out and having them ready. And then even the potatoes, they used to dig the potatoes until the tractor came along, and then the tractor had a potato digger that used to dig them out, and then you just had your buckets and you walked along and picked them up. And, you know, with the fork, you had to be pretty careful when you cut them that you didn't put the fork in where the potatoes were. But the potato digger most times got underneath the, you know, put had load enough to get underneath. You'd still cut a few, but they'd roll off, and then you picked them up, made it a lot easier.
And I think you've got a photo of the potatoes that have all been turned ready to... to be half-picked and bagged.
Originally they sort of had a plough and it had prongs out about, and of course the soil would fall through the prongs and the potatoes would stay. And then once we got the Ferguson, they had a potato digger. I mean, the Ferguson were a brilliant tractor, really. They were really way ahead of their time. They had a PTO which would drive things, and, you know, because they had a chain. So the potatoes would, and the dirt would come up, the dirt would fall through the chain and the potatoes would go out the back. But now the Ferguson, you know, even, you know, with the PTO you could put on a pulley. I know once they had trouble with electric motor pumping, and then, you know, even the, put the pulley on and put a belt around his shoulder, went one night down on the flat pumping water. And then the hydraulic hoist and the 3-point linkage were, you know, brilliant. You know, other ones, you know, had mechanical horses and all that. So that the Ferguson, yeah, they were sort of a head of time. Plus they made a lot of implements too, you know, like potato planters and tillers and, you know, everything. So, yeah, we had a Ford Ferguson. There was only 3 that came into South Australia, funny enough. We had one, and then Coventry's next door thought it was all right. So they bought one, and then a block bloke up at Loveday River here. But there's plenty in the eastern states, but a lot of the old people said, no, they're too light, they wouldn't be any good. But then eventually in the 50s, the Fergusons really took off. They had the British one, the T20, which was slightly bigger motor. The Ford Ferguson, I must admit, for ploughing in that heavy ground struggle, but they had the T20 in that, and Ferguson really took over the market. A lot sort of stuck to the David Browns, and, well, I mean, the Hellas Charmer and the Farmer, they could do row crop work, but, you know, they didn't have the versatility. Mm. Yeah. Now, what we were growing when I started was onions, potatoes, tomatoes, celery, cabbage, beetroot and trombone. And we dropped off we were growing the tomatoes for Rosella, but then I started growing a lot tomatoes up at the Riverland. They would bring them down, and ours weren't, you know, that fancy, but they had a lot of pulp in them, you know, whereas the Riverland were all water, really, but, you know, they could buy them cheaper, and so eventually it became unviable, so we stopped growing tomatoes in 62, and then we were sort of getting bigger in the celery, so we used to pull beetroot at the end of the serpent in, so we dropped the beetroot out. So that brought us back to 5, and then 1970 we dropped the trombones. Also, I mean, once I got to Virginia, they were starting to grow a lot of onions and potatoes. And this sort of short, you know, I mean, it wasn't worth us growing sort of after, you know, it was harvesting them after Christmas or early in January, so that cut our So we cut back on sort of onions, and we only had a few potatoes. We sort of grew potatoes. That, you know, if you've got the machinery, you might as well use it. We used to, but you'd have to sort of... It used to usually be a good price up until Christmas, and then, I mean, things, you know, slow down. It would take the market almost, you know, long weekend in January to pick up again. You know, people didn't seem to buy much. So, so we virtually became celery growers, really.
Right.
Yeah, from there. Well, we started to go up from the 60s and 70s, yes. And, yeah, I think our biggest year planting was in 1981. The American varieties started to come in then, so we... We had 222,000 plants we planted that year, and about 10 of them were this American variety. Harry in the 60s invented a Surrey planter. It wasn't flash, but it would work in the heavy black ground. And also with the flood irrigation, I started out, I was a water boy in 57, but in the 60s, you know, there's more and more with sprinklers. So we used to originally grow around on the slope, you know, and we used to survey and have a 3-inch fall every so often. But anyway, once the sprinklers come, we went to growing up and down the slope. We're on a slope from the slope from the east to the west, so we'd be able to go up and down, which is better drainage. And yeah, when Harry's planter wasn't, you know, had a few problems, but he wasn't the Rolls Royce, but he certainly did the job. So that
and was that. Using the tractor, this planter?
Well, the tractor powered it. No, they would, instead of bending over and planting, you're able to sit and use your fingers. You'd have your plants here in front of you in a crate, and you'd sort of sit there and plant. But the tractor went very slowly. We got a tractor that would sort of crawl along.
Had to wet the ground.
We wet the ground, yeah. That was where we first had trouble with premiers, but they were very... They covered a big area, but they left dry spots, so we changed to what were called butterflies. I think they call them rotifrones, and now people still use them on their lawn. But that didn't cover the area, but it was very fine and wet the ground very quickly and, you know, and evenly. So we learned to... We'd start them off once they got established. Well, we'd keep moving the rotifrones with the butterflies as we planted and replaced them with the premiers behind me. But, you know, once we had the plants established, and we always found that that first watering after doing your transplant was very important. You really need to get it very wet and set, get the ground to set down around, you know, that root of the plant. And you could see, you know, that fibre roots there that would get into it. Yeah, recently, I think doing about a 2-hour watering is really saturated. Mm. And even when we were out to Virginia, we sort of, that first watering, I reckon, was very important.
So two of the six brothers stayed on the land working?
Yes.
And the other four went off to other fields, is that right?
Yes, although our youngest brother, Bill, got killed in a car accident when he was 19, so he was studying architecture at Adelaide Uni and just went up for a weekend in a youth camp and they decided that they wanted to come down and have a hamburger, and they the lad driving the Volkswagen, Bill, was in the middle of the back seat, and they came down near past the old Eagle on the Hill. Went over the top of the road and hit something else, and the others had, Bill was in the middle and didn't have a seat belt, and yeah, he was the only one killed, but and Roger, he went into ENWS department. Robert, we've mentioned, did accountancy, and he worked for our dad's eldest sister, Eileen, married Roy Evans, and Roy Evans had an accountancy practice, so he took Robert in from school. And then Mum was a telephonist, and Mum was looking for work for me pretty well, and she was catching up with some of her old people that she worked with in the 1920s and 30s. They used to still meet and play cards once every 2 or 3 months, and one of them said, "Oh, there's job out for postal clerks in the post office. So I sat for that and passed that and went into the post office in 1960.
Mum always said you couldn't beat the public service. Yeah. She was a great one for it. I think you could be right.
I think it was a fairly common get a job with the government.
Yeah. Mm. You mentioned the people in the area. Robert's written a couple of notes, and he started a school at Athelstan when he turned 5 years old. And he believed he was young for his class, and he was all right at primary school, but he felt that that held him back a bit in senior years. When he started school at Athelstan, he used to walk the 1.5 kilometres. From our house, I proceeded through our property across the creek, across the horse paddock, across Lower Athelstan Road, into Oliver Marchant's property, then into Cliff Marchant, Cliff and Oliver were brothers' property, into the wide open spaces of the Lorenz brothers' paddock, bypassed their dam and onto Gord's Road, a further 300 metres, and so had me arriving at school. On the way home, I came down Russell Road, onto Lower Athelstan Road, and then via horse paddock home. In later years, the pushbike replaced the walking. And then on returning home from school one day in 1944, I think it was April, I noticed a new Ford V8 truck cabin and chassis. This was my father's first truck purchase. As it was wartime, World War II, all trucks coming into Australia from US and Canada became army property. However, the armed forces has released a number of trucks for private purpose, including for use in the primary production. The tray of this truck was built and fitted by A.J. Stock of Campbelltown, who did a variety of engineering work for market gardeners in the surrounding area. So,
yeah, they had a blacksmith too.
Okay.
Yeah, they, plough shears, they put a point on. And they were,
so you mentioned Virginia, so did you expand your property from Campbelltown and have other property as well?
We subdivided Atherton. I went with Dennis Searle and Dennis Lorenz. We brought a property out of Virginia and we used to commute every day. Searle sort of gave it away, but Dennis and I think about 2002, 2003, but Dennis had to have a hip replacement, so he said, you want to carry on? My son, Simon, was working there, but he didn't want to be working 7 days a week, so I said, no, so that was it. So, but we grew celery out there, that was basically what we did, and a few cabbage.
So when did you sell the Athelstan property?
Well, 92, but yeah, 90, they sort 92. Of, there was a, 1991, they sort of had started, hadn't they? The actual sale didn't take place, but they started before. 91 was a very, very wet winter year.
Mm.
So, yeah, they did start in 91, didn't they?
Yeah, that's right. So the actual handover didn't happen until 92, but they like got rid of the red shed and the sewer shed and the properties. And luckily, we weren't that interested in the old house, but John Wicks, who was part of the development, he said, no, I want to keep some lot of the history, and he has done that in the area, so he had the old house done up, and that was part of the development and sold as a housing block and with the house intact.
So that's still there, the original
It's still
house.
There and very much added to.
Yeah, yeah.
I've got a copy of the old one and the new one because it has been sold a couple of times since 92. So I wandered out and get a brochure and have a look at the places that has been changed over the years. So
as one thing, we kept the outside toilet right to the finish there. So a bit of a story there. Yeah, you know, we used to get the young ladies and that used to come because they'd never experienced anything like that. Especially because at night they would have to go out up, and it was a very dim a dimly lit toilet, but that wasn't so bad. But if I went there in the daylight, they used to share it with the red spiders who used to be in the nest. Yeah, so that was a bit of a talking point.
So who was living on the property in the 90s? Anyone?
No, you would.
No, Sewell bought a house, or built a house over the other side of the road on Lower Atherton Road. So the house was empty.
No, when would Mum have
gone? Mum moved out.
About 80, was it?
Yeah,
1980, like, yeah. I suppose.
Yeah. So your Mum was still in there until the 1980s, and then Cyril had it?
No. The Cyril and Paul were market gardening, but you only used the house for...
Yeah, we used the house for lunch and
yeah.
You had the telephone in there and all that. Yeah.
But otherwise it was just empty.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And that house goes right back to, we think, to 1838.
Right.
So I think that the house now was, no, I think it's about 1890, but there was a house back there in the 18. There was Pinkston had it, and there was someone, I suppose, is looking after the place. They must have had a fire and got burnt down, and then another chap built... sort of underground rooms were pretty original. Herman I think.
Yeah.
Did he build it or, with I connected with the I twins?
Yeah. So the original structure was 1838.
Yeah.
And it had underground rooms when we were there, and which had a tool shed. We had Harry White's father lived there for a while, and then inside again there was an area where we put all the seeds, kept
very
them cool.
And that we kept our seeds under the house.
So has the house still got an underground?
Yeah, well, with the house now, when John Wicks did it up, he went down and dug out and made them into ensuite downstairs and that, and into the old tool shed, which is still there and. Yeah, so
they were probably being built when your family was just considering moving to Australia.
Yes.
Yes, sounds like it.
That's right. And rumour has it that was where they hid from the local people, if there was, Aboriginals around and whatnot, that there's a couple of areas where there's little just breaks in the walls and that, where they obviously had a lookout or whatever. And under Mum and Dad's bedroom, there was a sort of where we held the seed. You could look out through a window to the side veranda, which there was a gap there. So obviously, we think that's where they lived in the early days. Mm. And then the other part was built on top.
Is there any oral history there about the Aboriginal people of the area?
No.
No stories or memories.
No. But this is only all hearsay because we're nearly 100 years before.
See, back then it was farming land rather than the gardens. Well, they would have.
The Pinkerton is covered again, as Margaret said, in the Elaine Warburton?
Elizabeth Warburton.
And she covers the Pinkerton part, which we believe is the old property.
The original.
Yeah.
Well, Pinkerton went right up through to the gorge,
And then Herman and I had it between, didn't he? So you're probably right.
Yeah.
At some stage, Herman and I...
Sid Warburton come around, he said about 1880 or something, but when he showed... There's an old fireplace underneath, but you reckon that would be 1860, that would have been going well back. Right. He didn't sort of leave us for a start, but once he saw the old stone, the limestone, it was more or less cut into a bit of a limestone. So I think that would have been, it wouldn't have been much of a place back in those early days, but
Being built on.
But that's where Pinkerton's place was, because I said when he come out, I think can he been all over the place, this Pinkerton, but he couldn't find the house where this chap was supposed to be looking after the property, but it had been burnt down. But that's in the book.
The history book.
History book, yeah. Mm.
Now, you've mentioned Harry White quite a bit, so he was obviously part of the backbone of the property. Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit more about Harry and his story?
Well, Harry sort of wandered around a fair bit when he was young. He, I know in about 1927 or 1928, he drove his buckboard right across to Perth.
Hmm.
And now it was all sand hills and everything. But he worked up at Nonning on a station up there at McTaggart's, are they?
Yeah, McTaggart's. Yeah, Nonning, Port Augusta.
He worked up there. But then he came down to Adelaide. I'm not too sure where his family would have been, but he married a Smith, a foreign Smith who lived. They were, you know, more or less connected to Harold Smith, you know, the Surrey grower. So they were on Darley Road. Then he bought a house in George Street, number 80 something, yeah, but the house is still there.
Still there, yep.
Yeah. So he wasn't that far from the property, it was, you know, less than a mile. So.
And he, I know when my eldest son was David and our boys, he said that's the fifth generation Emery that I've been involved with, because our great grandfather Robert would have been in his early 80s when Harry started working for Uncle Bill.
Yeah.
And he often used to come out, he used to talk, he had a walking stick.
Yeah, walking stick.
Dressed in his suit. And
see how deep the things
were. When he was digging, he would make sure that they dug it deep enough, you know, otherwise you could race along on the top or horse, you know, so yeah. he was checking that.
Sometimes the old hoers would be racing, they tend to cover the weeds rather than...
Right.
Cover. But so Harry would have, I don't know if he worked for anyone else, but he certainly started with Uncle Bill. When would be... Yeah.
Well, Robert died in 1935, so you were saying that he would have started
before,
while Robert, sometime
before,
in the...
Between 27 and...
Between 27 and 35.
30, oh, 33, because...
Or 33.
Oh, well, he was up there in 33,
he was up there,
so,
up
yeah.
Okay,
so,
yes.
And he was well entrenched with Uncle Bill then, so...
It's almost like an extended family member.
Yes, but even after he retired, he used to come up and help.
He was very, anything he did, he was excellent. Like, he built the celery shed, our place at Hillview had a veranda all the way around, and we built on to house it. Because there wasn't a room for us boys to sleep.
A big house with about four rooms.
So we all slept out in the veranda. So we covered in the western end and it with sort of masonite, was it?
Yeah, masonite, yeah.
And
the fly wire up the side with a, you know, roll blind that rolled down. How we used to get those gully winds, you lie there and think the roof's going to go in. But yeah, he did. He sold it. He made our own pipes. You know, he used to the tin pipes. He'd sort of solder the ends on and all that, and work on the tractors and
made a few implements, didn't he?
But even in the diaries, he was always working on the tractor. He put in the pumps and he did everything. Yeah,
yeah.
We were useless. Used to stand and watch him. Yeah,
yeah.
That's why I say we ran it when you said, "Do we take over?" No. No, we didn't.
So when you and your brother were working that land, was it still your mother's land, or was it divided up at all amongst
the
boys?
It was an estate. She had a life interest in it while she was alive.
Right.
Yeah, so it was left to the six boys
when
Dad died.
She was the oldest trustee, and they had that thought that the wife might go off and marry someone else.
So Mum was a trustee and the elders... That right, the co-trustees or something, while we were under 21 or whatever.
Yes, we operated for quite a while under E.R. Emery, and then she said, well, no. So we had to change to Emery and Sons. So, yeah.
Right.
She reckon she was doing all the work in that, and she's with an ancient, 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 and she's with to be recognised.
All right, fair enough. Okay, well, That's been an amazing story of the generations of on the land.
We've got
there.
A lot
are
of
there
written,
some
have
other
you got
things?
Time to... Well,
we've got a lot of written stuff whether you
a lot
want
of
to,
written stuff whether
yeah,
you want
to... But,
We can add that to the records unless you want... But I was going to say, is there other things that you think would be useful to add to this record?
Well, the silver industry was very... That was going strong. Sending it to me, I've got... In my bit, I've got how we sent... Initially, we sent all our silver to Victoria. That was the main market. South Australia was virtually the only one that grew any amount of silver back in the 30s.
And I think the thing you mentioned about liaising and whatever, like with the other market gardeners, we used to go down to Mile End to drop the celery off, and you sort of had to line up, you know. So you might have done the load and you were headed down the next morning. Well, if you were, you could have been lucky enough to be number one, but you might have been number 51 or whatever. So all the trucks were lined up and... The fire brigade, there's a lot of men from the fire brigades that would be in the trucks, and you would hand the crate to these fire brigade fellas, and they would fill the trucks up. And then when one truck was filled up, they had to shunt it down. And then you might have to back or, you know, to get in, you know, oh, we've got to go back here to finish off your load or whatever. Then so they just filled the trucks up as they went, and then... course, and they would travel overnight to Melbourne, the celery. But a lot of times you were down there and you'd meet some of your neighbours and talk about what was going on.
Because the firemen were, you know, shift workers, so, you know, they had the sort of contract and I suppose they earned extra money. They were very fit blokes and, you know, they'd be pretty jovial, have a bit of a stir with the growers. But just on the marketing side, they formed a sewage section back in 1937, so the growers combined and they employed someone to load, unload, and there was a panel of agents over there, so it was highly organised. You know, they worked as a group of sewage growers and they certainly benefited from it. But over the period of time, sort of in the 60s, or the Victoria growers, you know, they were sort of a bit like here, you know, they're in the suburbs. They got pushed out more into better soil, suited and broader acres, and they started growing a lot, so it first became unviable. So then we sent to Sydney, and we sent there for quite a number of years, but sort of Victoria started growing more, they started competing, then Queensland were growing it. So we sort of had to, then we came, because by this time there's a lot of growers going. At their peak there was 70 growers in Adelaide, Surrey growers in Adelaide area, you know, the western here. So, there was less growth. So then we had to turn and we sold here on the, through an agent on the Adelaide market. They supplied mostly the supermarkets and sold on the market. So, but I think there's only about one or maybe two Surrey growers in South Australia at the moment. And as I know, there were 70, a bit smaller thing, but it was certainly... a big industry, and you know, and South Australia, so it was very well known. But when the biggest problem, when the American Surrey come in, you know, I mean, the South Australian Surrey is very tall, I know, as you remember, but it's 92% water, which I should have said before, so it's got a, that's why the river was a big attraction for the growers. But it was the being, you know, it's held up by strings basically, and of course, the strings in the South Australian Surrey, I know. If you had back, remember those days, we didn't have to buy a chewing gum, put it that way. When we cut, we'd take a mouthful and chew it, spit it out. But when the American Surrey came up, it was almost not much more, well, probably less than half the height. The strings in it were much softer, and you probably know now, you can chew it.
Yes.
They first marketed as American Stringless, but, you know, a few people, you know, went and said, well, I'll be struck strings that are going to challenge, so they took strings off. But so, I mean, we had all our own varieties, which gave us a big advantage over the other. But then once, in the 80s, once the American come in, well, you go into the the seats, and you could buy it, and we were all on the same plane.
Given that the South Australian salary was, what, 60, 70 centimetres at least tall, crating it up and boxing it, was that a bit of an art form? Did you have to get special packaging or...?
Well, we used wooden crates and, the hard part was putting the lids on. You know, everyone sort of wanted to have the fullest and the best syrup and all that, so... the pack, initially, by hand, they used to hold the lid down. They made a pinus and you'd nail, you put three nails, so you had two lids, so you put the nails in. But then eventually they went to, of course they were 80 or 90 pounds, in weight, which is, 40 kilograms. Mm. I used to do the loading, so I used to put them up there and then throw them up. And that's why you had pretty fit people. But then eventually, it was a lot of manual labour. Even when they sent to Melbourne, wasn't too bad because all they did was change train drivers. But when it went to Sydney, Sydney was a different rail gauge, so they had to transfer that Surrey out of one into the. The other, so that was
extra handling.
Yeah, it was ice too. Those when they sent to Sydney, there was ice put in the freight vans. Then, of course, we came into we start to get more into forklifts and this type, and you just couldn't sort of lift those. Weren't allowed to lift those sort of weights. So they moved into wax cartons and. Of course, then, one thing about them, they had to be flat, to stack them, you couldn't have all this bending of timber and that, so they were about 20 kilos, say, roughly, and you used to put a eight on it, put them on a shed pallet, get out of eight, and they'd cart them down, we'd go five high, so, you forklift them on, and forklift them, much less work. And I think when they sent them to, they cut the trains out and went into rope, freight, especially when they went into the Sydney changed from the Haymarket out to the new Flemington markets, and the train went to the Flemington markets, but unfortunately pulled up outside. So I think it was going to cost 15 cents a carton to just load them onto a truck and take them around the market with the freight, the fridge vans could drive right into the market and drop them off at the different. Plus they had three sheds, was big in the market. But when we went local here, we used to put them into bins, 100 in a bin, or into plastic bags too. But plastic was terrible carrying, it's a bit like your spikes and stuff, you get plastic, you take them out straight away. But I suppose it just serves a purpose.
In the early days, you mentioned about the length of the celery. Well, we used to have a wooden board, didn't we? And I noticed Dad said that Harry White was making a wooden structure for cutting celery. So he had a long piece of a board, which was the length of the celery, had to fit into the crate, and then he'd sort of just make one end, he'd put the one right angle side and a longer one this end, see, so that you put it down on the butt, this end down on the butt, and you've got the knife and you cut it through the board.
Oh, right.
So that they went, so that people would cut the celery out of the ground, put them down on the ground, and then you'd come on, someone would come along and cut them the length to put them in the crate. So Harry, obviously making a board, that's back in 1938, but that's what we often in the holidays, that was our job, Harry'd have us going along, cutting them, and if we got too far behind, he'd come and cut them.
Give you a wriggle on.
Yeah, give a wriggle on. Yeah. We would be loading them on the truck, and after all, he'd come in and help us load them up. But yeah, that was probably what you're saying with the length of the surrey.
Surrey sort of remained its intense labour. You're still cutting it by hand. You had your potato diggers and your onion harvesters. Well, the carrot, I know when we first started Virginia, you know, the carrot growers used to have the Vietnamese. They have a gang of 20, and they'd come and pull the carrots and put them into bins. Well, after a while, you know, they've got these big harvesters, and they harvest the bins. You know, they like a potato digging, and, you know, they'd go out into bins. They just drive alongside. But I think, I don't know what, but, you know, in the potatoes, I think they could, they had big double ones. When we let, they could do about 70 tonne an hour. And then when we were growing potatoes, if we dug about 5 tonne before dinner, we reckon we did all right.
But, I could imagine
So Surrey did keep this manual labour more so. I know Jim Pearson, he had a harvester where it used to go and they'd come like that, but it's pretty rough. Surrey won't handle the rough like that, and then they would, it made it easier, they would trim it in the shed, but Jim was the only one that had, they may have them now open, I don't know. But we always cut by hand and put them into cages and then, you know, you pack by hand, yeah.
So fairly intensive work, long days, I imagine?
Yeah, it got that way, yes, yeah.
Mind you, if Mum had dinner on the table at 5.
That was one thing about those days. But we always, yes, we had about, we always had 12 to 1 lunch. That never, we never stopped that. But,
So later on you probably worked a lot longer.
You will get seabeds and you've got a, you know, well, you get days like last Saturday and that, you know, you've probably got to water 3, maybe 4 times. Mm-hmm. Just, you had to keep young, you know, like that, you know, wet. But, you know, but things change, you know, that I read in the diaries, you know, a lot of amount of hoeing they used to do in the onions, but I know we cut that back we used to put, as they come up to the, you know, you plant the seed, the onion would come up like a hairpin, and we used to use power kerosene, and any weeds up we used to go through, and that would burn the weeds and not the, so that used to give us a head start. And then later on now you've got sprays to kill all the weeds and that, they come in, you know, the surrey is the same, the, we used to have to hoe the surrey, but that went out with the, you know, sprays and that.
Mm. So much more organic in the early days, really.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, it's like the Bourbon, you know, it's the only way they do it, but now I'm sure there's, well, when I started, we used to get, still getting Bourbon on the headlands, you know, where the, you know, it wasn't work, but I don't think there was any better when, you know, when you weed, and some of those knockdown sprays would have just, well, they kill everything, unfortunately. You used to have kangaroo paws growing around the place, but they went. We did have on the what we call the horse paddock, we used to have a row of almonds along Lower Atherton Road and down to the creek, didn't we?
Yeah,
sort of. You have to knock them and that.
I think I remember those actually.
And we have got photos in that too.
We'll talk about your photos and getting those. Well, I think I've covered pretty much everything that I had as part of this project, because you've given a really extensive view of that. Was there anything else that any of you wanted to add, or do you think we haven't covered?
No, I think that's pretty right. We've got a lot here, which you might like, you know, as a record, you know, that you might like to keep. Yeah.
I've sort of got my probably told fairly well what I've in that. Robert's got his in writing, Brian's got...
Yeah, I've got it.
I know, would you like to take him and a bit of a read through?
All right, well, I might say thank you very much. It's been very interesting and a few good chuckles. And I'll stop this now.